Blood explodes in the truck cab. Jim pulls off a few more rounds into the truck's front tires, which rupture. Huge straps of tires sail high into the air. Then he blows the front tires on the truck immediately behind them and takes out the rear tires on the trailer whose cab is next to them. The trucks veer violently from one side to the other. The one next to them immediately begins to slow down under the drag of its deflated rear tires. He can see the panic in the face of the driver directly behind as his truck smashes into the truck next to it. Both rapidly jackknife. The collision is joined by the decelerating truck to their right. 80,000-pound trailers shear their mounts and tumble over one another, crushing the cabs. Behind in both lanes are clustered the better part of 50 or more trucks, all come for the entertainment of some four-wheeler getting his due. These two smash at highway speed into the first wreck with millions of pounds of force. Fuel explodes. A gasoline tanker ruptures and a shearing red fireball balloons into the blue sky. A propane tanker splits and blows. The wreckage covers more than a mile. The blocking trucks ahead and to the right of Ed and Jim quickly pull over into the breakdown lane. The fast lane trucks pull right and slow down. Ed has a clear road ahead. He guns the motor. Ahead, as far as the eye can see, all the 18-wheelers are pulled over to the side. As they pass on, a few shots ring out. Jim says, "Son of a bitch!" He lowers the window and sprays each cab as they speed by. No more shots are directed their way. All the drivers are crouched down in their seats or hiding behind the wheel hubs away from the highway. A few diesel tanks rupture from the shots and ignite. Jim returns to the front seat and raises the seat back. Ed slyly says, "Now wasn't that special?" The smoke can be seen for miles across Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. Jim says, "Oh yeah, that was special. Very special. Dude, we better get another car. I think this one might be hot. How about this next exit? What do you have in mind?" "Oh, let's drive out some country road and find a farm. People out there don't suspect nothing. We can take their car. And what about the farmer? He won't be missed, dude. At least not for a while," chuckles Ed. Ed pulls off the interstate onto a short strip of blacktop and drives east for about a mile where it intersects a north-south gravel road. Jim says, "See out there in the distance? Looks like a prosperous little farm. Let's go see if anyone's home." Ed guns the motor and they bounce along on the uneven pavement heading towards the unsuspecting occupants of a small cluster of farm buildings a few miles distant. A few minutes later, they arrive at the long crushed stone driveway leading to the main house and buildings. Ed turns left and heads north towards the farm. A late model car is parked outside the house. They pull their car up to the one in the farmyard, get out, and trudge through the snow to the front door. Jim knocks on the door while Ed stands to one side. After a minute, they hear footsteps, and the door opens. It's the farmer, a guy about 50 years old holding eyeglasses in one hand and a newspaper in the other. "Howdy, guys. What can I do for you?" greets the farmer as he holds the storm door open. Jim says, "I think we're lost. Could you give us a hand reading this map?" as he pulls out a map that he picked up at the truck stop. "Sure. Come on in. Margie, we got some company. You guys want some coffee?" Jim says, "You bet. Can you bring out some coffee, honey?" From the back of the house, they hear a woman's voice say, "On my way, dear. How many?" "Two. Come on in the dining room. We'll open up that map. Those IA dot maps are very detailed. Some of the best maps you can get." He leads them to the left into the dining room. The house is the traditional four-square design found in farms throughout the prairies. Farmer flips on the overhead Art Deco chandelier and unfolds the map as his wife joins them with a tray with a coffee pot, cups of cream, sugar, and a plate of sugar cookies that she's recently baked. She sets the tray out and says, "Help yourself, boys." The farmer says, "Well, here's where we are," pointing to the map. The farmer is pointing at a faint gray line slightly east of the dark red interstate line. "Now, where are you trying to get to?" "Omaha," says Ed. "Well," laughs the farmer, "you sure are on the wrong road. Omaha's over there. You'd be out on the interstate. Just go down this road. That'll put you on the interstate." "Oh, yeah, and we want your car," says Ed, who's now pulled out a gun. Jim says, "Yep," as he pulls out his gun, too. The farmer's wife gives a horrified but soft cry. The farmer drops his reading glasses, steps back, and says, "What's this?" "I guess you'd call it a stick-up. That right, Jim?" says Ed. "I think that's what you'd call it, Ed." "Where are your car keys?" says Jim. The farmer reaches in his pocket and pulls them out and hands them over. "Now you two, on the floor, face down," says Jim. The farmer and his wife comply, heads flat on the floor, facing one another in terror. Jim says, "You want to do the honors?" Ed says, "Okay," and casually shoots both in the head in quick succession. Then he says, "How about that coffee?" "Sounds good to me." They drink the coffee and finish off the cookies. Then, carefully wiping for any prints and taking the map, Jim says, "Out here it'll be days before anyone finds them. Leave a light on in case someone notices the house is dark." Ed replies, "You bet. Let's go." They find the farmhouse and transfer their goods into the farmer's car. Carefully, they wipe down their own car for prints with towels from the house, then get in the farmer's car and drive off towards the interstate. Winter crows circle curiously above. Time, 1 p.m. On the interstate, traffic is light due to the carnage a few miles south. Traffic there is blocked in both directions. Ed and Jim have the road to themselves and are making good time. They crossed the bridge at Council Bluffs into Nebraska a little after 1 p.m. After passing through downtown, Jim says, "Hey, I think that's the exit up ahead." "Yep, 126th Street," as he pulls the car onto the exit ramp and heads south, then east on Giles Road a few miles to the motel where they've made reservation the night before. Jim pulls into the parking lot and they register using phony IDs. They pay cash, which upsets the desk clerk. She gives them a room on the far side of the building. They pull the car around and take several dark canvas suitcases into the room. Jim sits down at the small table in the room and pulls out a map of Omaha, saying, "Let's see where we go from here. I've only been out here once before. I'm not sure I remember the way." "It's near the railroad yards, I remember. Right next to them, I think," says Ed. "Here, you want a pop?" "Yeah, and toss me that ashtray. This may take a while." Ed slouches on an easy chair, takes a remote, and turns the TV on. He flicks his lighter and draws on a cigarette, then starts channel surfing. He quickly finds an all-news channel, which, like all the others, is doing wall-to-wall coverage of the wreckage on I-29 from a few hours earlier. "Hey, look at this, man. You're fucking famous," says Ed. Jim looks up at the TV and sees helicopter shots of the bloodshed on the interstate. There is wreckage everywhere. They watch burning cars and trucks, fire engines, helicopters airlifting casualties, blood-drenched snow, police cars from half of Iowa, it seems. Small herds of hogs escape from their rolling hog lots, wander aimlessly and dazed in the chaotic scene. The Chiron banner at the bottom of the screen screams in bold white letters on a blood-red background. Mayhem on I-29. "Wow, me and my little gun caused all that?" "Well, I did the driving," says Ed. "And very well, too. Hey, look at all them dead hogs and the burnt-out tankers. Must have been some fire, dude. Too bad there wasn't a truckload of pork chop helper. Or trucker helper." They both watch in awe at their handiwork until Jim notices the time in the lower corner of the screen and says, "Hey, look, we gotta get out of here or we'll be late. I figured out the directions. It should take about 15 minutes to get to Joe's warehouse." They get up, pull on their jackets, gloves, and stocking caps and head back to the car. A quarter hour later, they arrive at Joe's warehouse. "That must be the parking lot Joe talked about over there," says Ed. They hop out of the car and instinctively look suspiciously around them to see if someone's watching. Then jog across to the warehouse in the howling wind. Sid is waiting for them at the door. Waiting inside the office for them are Joe and Mark. Jim and Ed introduce themselves, then Jim says, "Our car's hot. We kind of borrowed it after that little road rage incident out on I-29. "Yeah, I heard about that. When you say borrowed, does that mean there are bodies involved?" "Yeah, well, they won't be talking. But it's cool. They won't be found for a while either." "In Iowa?" "Yeah." "Okay, here's the keys to that red Grand Am out there," says Joe as he hands a key ring of keys to him. "Give me the keys to your car. I'll have it wiped for prints and ditched on some county road over there." At Moroan, Todd flips open his cell phone, hits a memory dialer sequence, and says, "Can you get a GPS locator and an audio bug on that Grand Am on the lot across the street from the warehouse, Sean?" "Thanks." He flips the phone closed and looks at the others and says, "Sean says he can do it." At the warehouse, Jim tosses the key to the farmer's car, which has a little plastic locket keychain with a picture of the farmer's wife in it. Joe looks at it for a moment, then up at Jim, then pockets the keys. "Looks like he had a wife." "Yeah, she won't be doing any talking either. But she made us some nice cookies," says Ed casually. Mark and Sid eye each other uncomfortably and squirm a bit in their chairs. Joe picks up the phone and punches a number. When it answers, he says, "I'm down to my office. I got a job for you and Roger," and hangs up. Joe pulls out a file of papers from his desk and says, "Here's the basic layout of the club. It's a renovated old five-story warehouse. On the top floor are apartments where the owner and some of his partners live. That's where we're sure Mike is holed up." Pointing to one of the diagrams, he continues, "And here is the service entrance where they bring in their beer, food, and so forth. This is where you'll be making your delivery. There's a short ramp up to a back room where they store the beer and things. This is where you'll drop off the kegs and then put the detonator between the kegs. Make sure the RDX kegs are far to the back so they won't be used first. We don't want them trying to tap them or anything, you know." "Well, at least not while we're still there," says Jim. Joe continues, "Here's some pictures of the interior and exterior of the club. This is a picture of the loading dock where the beer is delivered." "Looks good," says Ed. "Now, the beer deliveries are usually around 2 p.m, and Friday calls for about 12 kegs. But first, the truck stops at this bar a few blocks away to make a delivery before heading to Moroan." Pointing to a picture of the alley behind the bar where the truck stops before going to Moroan, Joe says, "Here's the plan. Mark and Sid will take a van with the RDX trucks and wait on the street for the beer truck to pull up this alley. This is a good place to take the truck. There are no overlooking windows and it's not visible from the main street. While the driver is making his delivery, Mark and Sid will pull in behind the beer truck. You two will park your car and wait up here. When the driver comes out, Mark and Sid will grab him and put him in the van. Then they'll load the RDX kegs onto the beer truck truck. You two take it from there. Give Mark your car keys and he'll bring it back here and park it across the street while Sid takes care of the van. Take the beer truck to Morone, make the delivery, then bring the truck back here and park it in the warehouse. Mark will give you your keys and then you two can hit the road. Got it? Sounds like you want us out of town, asks Jim. The fewer people here, the better. What happens to the beer truck? Mark and Sid will take the beer truck and the drivers a few miles south of here. They'll OD him with meth and then run the truck and the driver off an old bridge into the Missouri River. It'll look like an accident by some twinked-out temp on dope. No one will care anyway. They'll have more pressing problems with a few hundred casualties in a bombed-out warehouse. Any questions? Nope. Sounds good to me. Are the RDX kegs the same weight as the regular kegs? Asks Ed. Yes. They put weights in the bottom and top to make sure they'd have the same feel as regular kegs in case anyone tries to give you a hand. The RDX kegs, however, will have a little red sticker on top. That's how you know them. I'll show you them when they arrive here tomorrow afternoon. How friendly is the driver with the bar staff? Asks Jim. Good news there. The regular driver is on vacation with his kids in Florida, and they've been using substitutes. They won't ask any questions if they don't recognize you. You don't need any uniforms either. Not in this weather. Lucky bastard who gets Friday's run then, says Ed. Yep, I guess he won't be going home this weekend. Luck of the draw, says Joe. There's a knock on the door, and Nick, one of the warehouse men, enters. Joe says, you and Roger take that white car across the street and dump it in Iowa so it won't be found for a while. Got it? He hands Nick the keys to Ed and Jim's stolen car. Nick is one of the guys who tried to abduct Mike, and so is Roger. Nick was the one who called out Lance. His jaw is still wired, and his face still shows the swelling from the beating he took. Okay, boss, mumbles Nick as he takes the keys and leaves, shutting the door behind him.